Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a special guest, somebody who was with us before, who I really enjoyed our conversation. And in as a physician, I'm seeing so many, holes that have developed between the doctor and the patient. And I feel now is the right time to talk with a practitioner who lives this and who understands the importance of the doctor-patient relationship. She's a naturopathic physician, and she has a practice that is more focused on health of the patient and not just the sickness that we all experience in our healthcare system. So I wanted to welcome again Dr. Amber Belt to the show. And people can go to her website, dramberbelt.com, where there's a wealth of information. But I wanted to start off by once again welcoming you back to the show. And I wanted to get your take on what experience have you had with your patients? You have a special select group where they're all into their health, I would imagine, and they want to be partners in their care. But since you finished training to today, do you see a difference in the doctor-patient relationship?
Yes, and thank you for having me back on. And I would say that I do see a difference, particularly in the last 5 years, where people have lost more trust in, more specifically in the conventional care system. And so they want to know, and they want to feel empowered in their decisions rather than just sort of blindly accepting what their doctor has to say. I think that doctor as God trend was dying, but definitely since 2020, it's on its last legs.
I think that's true. And from the practice of medicine, the standard practice of medicine, I think that time has been the thing that's eroded it the most. We used to be able to spend 30, 40 minutes on average with our patients, and now it's down to 7. Do you think that is a contributing factor?
Absolutely. I'm sitting here nodding my head very vigorously because I agree. People are very frustrated that they get so little time with their doctor. They leave a lot of times with more questions than they had coming in. So I think that is true. It definitely erodes the trust there.
And from the patient, well, actually from the doctor training perspective, I'm far away from it. But for us, it was all about the history. We were taught that you do your examination to prove what the diagnosis you came up with by taking a solid, thorough history. There's so much fragmentation. I mean, you've got people who just do the vitals, people who take the history, people who are writing down writing down the notes as a stenographer. And then the doctor comes in and reviews, I think, everything that's gone on before, but there's no laying of hands on the patient or having any kind of give and take, right? So it's just the doctor writing prescription and then out to the next one. That's like a conveyor belt type of medicine that I think should stop. I hope it does at some point.
Yeah, I think so. And I think one thing that patients get frustrated about too is they take time to fill out their forms and give that history in their chart. And a lot of times I think that doctors are so pressed for time that they can't even read the patient's history in the chart. So things get missed. And I think that on the patient end, that drives their frustration as well.
I would agree. And then health, delivering health care is an art, but it's also, it's meticulous because you're actually forming your diagnoses, your differential based on what questions you need to ask. And I don't know if you can answer this question, but it seems that there's no art to medicine. It's very algorithm driven. So if someone comes in with a symptom, you've got a tree, a decision tree that's already made out for you. There's no deviating from the end point. It's going to be X, Y, or Z no matter what. And if it's not, I don't know, or I'm baffled. I mean, do you feel that that's part of the problem that it's this, what do you want to call it? I forget what they called it. The oh my gosh, I can't believe I can't remember what it's called, but the way they've parsed it out, it's all drug driven and evidence-based. That's it. Evidence-based medicine. That's the bane of a holistic approach, isn't it?
Yes, it's difficult. It's so funny that you say that, because I made a post on Instagram a few weeks ago that says, it said something along the lines of medicine should not be an algebra equation where you just sort of plug in the condition and the patient's age, and then you get, it spits out the medication at the other end of it. And it is, it's very formulaic, and we have lost the art. I think in naturopathic practice, I haven't, but I think in the conventional system, the art is lost. And I think you're right that that comes back to the amount of time. It's hard to get nuance with a patient when you're crunched into less than 10 minutes.
I agree. And, you know, it just struck me as you were saying that. I think the thing that's been driving this path has been the almighty data, right? Everything's about data. And it's not about the person. It's getting a number, plugging it in, getting as much information as you can, which a lot of times it's non sequitur. Like, I don't ask these questions of, especially an ENT, when's the first time that you had sex? That's kind of not my business. But these EMRs are populating it with all these questions, and people answer that. That's what I'm really shocked at. I wouldn't give up most of this information because it's not pertinent to why I'm there. But people do. And I don't think people realize that that data stream follows them. It's not just locked in the doctor's office. It's going to the insurance companies. It's going to, if you have any kind of Affordable Act plan, it's going to the government as well, all the alphabet agencies. So the day of the paper chart, where whatever you wrote was in your office locked away, that's gone.
Wow, that's concerning. I actually didn't know that. I think, you know, I use EMR, but I don't know that it's connected to anything bigger. But that certainly has to be correct if it's connected to a hospital EMR. And in the small practices that are privately owned are dying and being taken over by corporate medicine. So yes, I never thought of that before, but that sort of floors me.
I know, it's a centralization of your most personal data. What it's to me, what you say to your pastor, your priest, whomever, and what you say to your doctors between you and them. And I mean, I've had shows where they talked about HIPAA. And the fact that HIPAA doesn't mean that your information is private, just means where we can send it.
Right.
So when you see your patients now, have you gotten any feedback from them? They must be feeling like they're your breath of fresh air because you actually listen to them, take the time, and together you guys make your treatment plan. How shocked are they when they come to see you that it's completely not what they've ever had?
It's actually great. And I love that part of my practice because I have the luxury of spending with a first time patient, I get to spend an hour. And if it's somebody who's very complicated, I'll even budget more time. And the feedback that I get overwhelmingly is that I've never had anyone listen to me like this before because I'm not compartmentalized. I need to know there, because of the way I approach them as a whole person, I do need to know that whole history because I'm trying to put the puzzle together so that we can develop a treatment plan that makes sense for them. And so they love it. And I love it because I get to know them as a person.
It's wonderful when it's your decision-making power and not, it's not going to be covered or it's denied because it wasn't in some silo. I mean, that's where the frustration comes in, I would think, from every doctor who knew what the system was before this all came online. I think we've lost a lot of colleagues, haven't we, from this changeover to this precision, quote unquote, precision medicine and data-driven healthcare.
Yes, I think so. I wrote a Substack article, I think it was a couple years ago, about how we're losing particularly primary care physicians because of the burnout and because they're expected to see, I mean, I don't envy them at all. They're expected to see such a high volume of patients. And I don't know how they do it because I get behind in my charting with my small practice. I can't imagine having to chart and keep up with the paperwork and the pace all the time. I can understand why there is so much burnout.
And I think, again, the system has changed because there's so much burnout. There's so many other layers to the system. You have nurse and everybody, not only us, but the nurses too. They have nursing techs, you know, associate nurses, like four different layers before you get to the RN. And it's the same thing now with doctors. You've got physician assistants, you've got nurse practitioners who left nursing and are now doing primary care. And the system was, I think it was pretty good back in the day because people were actually not driven by time and money was not taken from the system. It seems another thing that stuns me still is that the healthcare dollar, most of it doesn't go to the doctor. The people who are actually doing the work get the least of the pie, like 7 cents per dollar. That doesn't even make sense, but that's why they have to grind to see double, triple, because they have to make up that difference.
Yeah.
It's just, we don't really have an advocate that I can see.
Yeah. I didn't know that statistic about 7 cents on the dollar. And if I think of the risk that we as doctors take, taking care of our patients, we put ourselves at a big risk. And that is unacceptable.
It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, that healthcare pie dollar, you know, most of it's going to the administration of medicine. I guess it's the big box healthcare system with the hospitals, insurance market, and they're really making out like bandits, honestly. People pay a premium and they don't get their money's worth at all. And then they have to pay a copay and a deductible. So I'm not sure how that system actually continues without some serious help from everything, you know, powers that be kind of situation. But we wonder why it's so expensive. But the dollar of the doctor hasn't changed. I still pretty much charge the same thing I did when I opened my practice, but I don't, you know, but I'm unusual probably, but I've streamlined. But if you're in a hospital setting, it's amazing. Just walking in the door, an ER, for example, costs you so much money and they end up not treating you and sending you for follow-up with your family practice or the specialist, but they really don't do anything. I guess unless you're shot or you have a heart attack, you might get some work done. But otherwise,
right? Yeah. That's funny. That's true. My son had a pretty serious mountain bike accident last summer, and it cost $20,000. I mean, we have insurance, and we weren't, but they did what they needed to do, stitched him up, and did the CT scan. But you know, to get him over his brain injury, I'm the one who took care of that. There just aren't the resources for that kind of follow up a lot of times.
I agree. Or did they actually, not to be personal, but did they consult neurology or any other thing? Or they just did the scan and said follow up with the neurologist afterwards?
I don't think they consulted neurology. I did get his chart and I read it, but it's been long enough that I don't remember neurology being called in for him, but he was out of it.
I'm glad he's okay.
Yeah. And luckily, I mean, his girlfriend was there to help advocate for him. But yeah, he called me afterwards and he kept repeating himself. And it was definitely a decent concussion.
Wow. Well, thank goodness he's okay. And on that note, let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Amber Bell. And you know, I know we talked about this when you first came on the show, but I want our listeners to get a flavor of how you ended up going down the pathway of naturopathic and really taking care of the whole patient instead of the typical, you know, allopathic healthcare.
Yeah. So I think like a lot of people in healthcare, my journey sort of started with my own health, and I was given, I don't even know how many rounds of antibiotics as a child. I had asthma, so it seemed like every time I got a cold, I got amoxicillin. And it really did. I mean, it wrecked my digestive function. Like it just, you know, it just kind of wrecked my gut, all of those antibiotics. So I started, first I explored diet because very early on, I recognized that what I ate directly impacted how my gut feels. And then I got more interested in herbs and acupuncture and homeopathic remedies, but I didn't, it was kind of, it wasn't pre-internet, but not everything was on the internet like it is now. And I was really trying to find a place that would tie all of those things together. And I happened to see, I happened to kind of stumble on naturopathic medicine, and instantly I knew that that was the right fit. It kind of housed everything I wanted for my own health under one umbrella. And it, and as I learned more about it, I learned more about, oh, we're just, I mean, it's simply just treating the whole person, and we get to use all of these different modalities to help people out.
Well, for the, those that don't know, and I think if you turn on the TV, people are inundated with, there's a drug for every ailment. And my training, and I get your take on this, would it be wise for the system to exhaust all, you know, pre-treatment remedies? You know, if you're having sleep apnea, lose weight, for example, or blood pressure or diabetes, do you think that the system would actually work better if they worked on the people that actually are in need of it, as opposed to creating this pathway where you're pre-hypertensive, pre-diabetic, and there's no nutritionist involved with these things? Usually it's a medicine to treat that. Do you think that if we change that direction and actually used smart preventative medicine, whether that be herbs or energy medicine or just other modalities to get the patient away from becoming the disease, would that make a difference, do you think?
I think so. I think that, you know, I think that is the way that health truly lies. I don't think that, I mean, of course, bringing down someone's hypertension with a medication is important, but that still doesn't fix the insulin resistance that's, you know, almost certainly going on. Like a statin will bring down their cholesterol, but it's, you know, it's not fixing their high blood sugar or, the, you know, all those other problems. And I don't mind it being both and. I don't mind, you know, if I'm seeing a patient with hypertension, I don't mind prescribing them an antihypertensive while we're working on their weight loss and while we're getting them moving. But the goal would be to, as they get healthy, to be able to back them off of that medication.
Oh, I totally agree. I never see that. When I have patients come in, they've been on omeprazole or whatever the medicine is for years, no adjustments, no change in their routine to get them off. And maybe patients also need to be involved with this, that I don't want to take this forever. How can we do this in a way that I'm going to wean off and I'm going to be self, you know, self-sufficient, in lack of a better way to put it. So do you think patients need to be more active instead of just passively accepting it and putting it in their mouth? And my favorite is, I don't know what it is, but I take it. I don't even understand that. I don't.
I don't either. Oh my gosh. I don't have very many patients who say that, but my patients are, they're more likely to self-advocate. And I think that I do encourage patients to advocate for themselves. And I think it's really important to, you know, to push, not in a mean way, but push your doctor and say, you know, I do want to wean off of this. Can we create a plan to do that? And my experience is that people are reluctant to do that because they don't want to be a problem patient. And it, of course, in my mind, I'm thinking, you're not a problem patient. No. You're just advocating for yourself.
Well, someone has to make the change then, right? Mm-hmm. So my first thought when I first became more aware of how the healthcare system was working, as a patient, I would just leave the practice, right? There, the people who are pushing this type of healthcare only understand money, right? So if you stop seeing them and find an alternate path, you know, people start to wake up when their patient load drops, and it's for specific, maybe a patient might tell them, I want someone's going to talk to me. I want someone's going to be a partner in my care, and you're not that person. Maybe that would be the thing that starts to change this system.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that, yeah, the thing that makes them pay attention is the loss and the when it makes a dent in their profit. And that's just the way it is, sad as it is.
It is, and everywhere. I mean, we're seeing, about 15, 20 years ago, did we even have any organic labels that really, like in the supermarkets, or you had to go somewhere else, health food store or something like that, and they're taking high fructose corn syrup out of products, they're getting rid of, or at least we have a choice if we look for it, things that are not genetically modified. And so it seems that if we as consumers become more savvy, they will make the product that they're going to sell. So yes, if you're going to continue to buy it and complain, you're not helping yourself.
That's true. That is so true. Yeah. Yeah. And I think people feel trapped a lot of times because I do think that in many cases, and you know, I think it depends to some degree on where you live, but your choices are so limited that to go to somebody who will actually listen to you, you're going to be paying out of your pocket. Mm-hmm. And there's a good amount of people that just can't afford that. So I don't know. I think they feel stuck.
Well, you know, there are direct primary care practices who have a monthly rate, and it's like some of my colleagues, it's like $150 a month for a family of four. I think that's affordable, frankly. And at some point, if you can spend your money unwisely and really get to the point of my health is the most important resource that I have, and I'm going to take care of that first, I think it might be easier for people to access the system. And, you know, I think we're also taught that if it's not insurance, then it's too expensive. In actuality, it's the opposite. That is complete marketing.
Mm-hmm. That is very true. That is very true. I like the direct primary care model.
I mean, it makes sense. And then people, you actually don't see them very often because when they take better care of themselves. I don't want to give up money if it's cash. I really don't. I don't like to spend it. It's kind of the same thing. If I have money in the game, if I'm paying the doctor directly a month, I'm going to get my money's worth. If that means I'm going to have longer consults, listen to things to keep me healthy. I just think it changes the energy. So the patient becomes more of the power, and it should be, you know, mm-hmm. equal, but the patient has a lot more power than they ever had or will have in a system that just says, do this or else.
Yeah. It's a different way. Cause we were talking about kind of holding the doctor accountable for the treatment plan and how do we wean off this? That's a model that it kind of holds the patient accountable mm-hmm. as well. And it's hard to, with insurance, it's the opposite. You're just kind of receiving care. You don't really have a lot of say in it.
No. And if you, God forbid, something catastrophic happens, you really don't have any say in it. You can't go out of the country in some of these plans. You can't do alternative treatments, or they'll limit how many treatments you can have. If you run out of the amount covered for your chemo or something, that's it. Or you reach your out-of-pocket max, that's it. I mean, it's not, I think they need to take a deep dive, look at how the insurance paradigm works. It changed. So initially it was just covering big ticket items. It wasn't daily. Like you go for a doctor's office visit, it wasn't covered. If you had to have a lab surgery, that makes sense to me. Those are big ticket items. But mm-hmm. as soon as they took the first healthcare dollar, that they were controlling that, that's when it really started to go south.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I think you're probably right. I am. It makes me feel so fortunate. I've never taken insurance. I'll help patients bill insurance for their labs and things like that. But yeah, I can't imagine the strain of that.
Oh, you're really blessed, because usually what happens is you get into the insurance provider portal mode and you get so frustrated, or you go out of business mm-hmm. and you find something like direct primary care where you've just cut them out completely. There's just absolute joy in those doctors. There's just like a lightness compared to what they did and where they are now. And to me, it's a two-tier system. It was starting that way, but now it really is, where you've got people who are dependent on their insurance, whether that's government-based or Affordable Care Act-based, that sort of thing. and people who pay cash. You can get whatever you want. You can have whatever procedure you want. It's a fraction of the cost of what they bill to the insurance plans. It's really, there seems to be something really wrong with that, that it can cost you 70% less.
Yes.
If you pay cash versus insurance, there's something really, really wrong with that system. Yeah.
Yeah. I know I'll tell people, you know, if there are certain lab tests that I'll tell people, just pay cash for it, because if your insurance kicks it back to you, it's going to be several hundred dollars. And this lab test costs $40 cash. So let's just hedge our bets and get you the lower price out of the gate. But yeah, I do feel blessed that I don't have to deal with a lot of that. And I'm sure the doctors who get out of it just feel like a freedom to practice like they want to and like they know they should be doing.
Exactly. I don't think the burnout rate is if there's any at all, it's a fraction of what we're seeing on the typical healthcare system model. I mean, I've had friends who were private practice and then sold their practice and went into the hospital system. I don't have one of them that have anything good to say. They're just getting through the motions until they can retire. And I grew up under things like Dr. Welby, you know, where he was 90 or so, and he was practicing with joy. That's the model that I grew up looking at. And it's not that way anymore.
No, it's not. And have you noticed, I've noticed this, that it's getting more and more difficult to find, for primary care, to find an MD or a DO to actually go to. And it's all, like, a lot of my patients really can find a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant because so many physicians are leaving that system.
Wow, I didn't know that was affecting primary care like that. I know that there's been, you know, online, we have groups of doctors who speak about what's changing. And the legislation is actually making nurse practitioners and physician assistants, you know, on a legal level, they can do whatever a doctor can do, except they don't really take responsibility in terms of malpractice, which I don't get. If you're going to have that kind of power, in my opinion, you need to carry the malpractice and the choices that you make. So again, doctors are hurting themselves with this one, because I wouldn't oversee a mid-level that I wasn't working directly with. So they might have a doctor covering all nurses in a different part of the city or a different state. It's a really Wild West kind of system, but it encourages this, which there's no downside for this. If something bad happens, it's the doctor's fault. I mean, who puts himself in that kind of position? That doesn't even make sense.
No, especially for 7 cents on the dollar. That's wild. No. That's such a huge risk.
It is. And to top it off, to take it for somebody else, not even what you're doing, but what someone else is doing. On that note, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, we're going to take a break so you can come back and get that thought out. So let's take our second break. You're living in the solution.
You're listening to Dr. Elena George, advocate for living in the solution.
Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Amber Belt. And before the break, I'm so sorry to have cut you off. I mean, it's just, the system is not good. I mean, it's not getting any better because we have all these people who are, let's face it, and it's nothing, it's just training. It's less time, less hours in training, to me, cannot equate to what we spend in medical school, what we spend in residency. It's just not the same. If they want to make it longer and they want to have the same type of courses, then that's another thing. I don't think that's going to happen, though. A 12-week nursing courses and maybe a year and a half of PA school, to me, is not the same as 4 years of medical school and 3 to 4 years, up to 10 years of residency. It just doesn't make sense.
No, I agree with that. And I can't imagine, you were saying that there are physicians who will supervise several nurse practitioners or PAs. How do you do that in such a volume and truly be supervising? So that's a Wild West situation for sure.
It is, but because the mentality is the healthcare system doesn't have enough doctors. But why is that? It's because of what you did to it. So now we have to expand the role and the I guess, the scope of practice. But I'm sorry, I don't want someone who hasn't trained properly, cutting on me, injecting me with anything, doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
But that's where you provide for the patients who are savvy. You're getting a doctor who can treat the breadth of something. So I love the fact that you said that it's not one way or another. It depends on the patient, right? You'll go a holistic path if that patient would benefit from it, but it's not the only thing you do. Is that a good way to think about it?
It is. And for me, it's when we're creating a treatment plan, it's important to me to meet the patient where they're at. And let's say we're making some changes to their diet because they're pre-diabetic, because I swear everyone's pre-diabetic now, and that's going to take a little time. You know, maybe we'll use some herbs or maybe even a medication to treat that presenting symptom while we're doing that groundwork underneath to shore up the foundations of their health. So I don't mind using both, but there is always a plan, hopefully, to get them off of the thing that we're managing, whether it's medication or an herb or whatever that we're managing symptoms with, because I want those symptoms to go away because they've had a return to health.
Exactly. That means you did your job, right? So it's not about managing a disease. It's about correcting it so that you can have the patient live their life and not have to see you. People don't, I don't know if doctors understand that or the healthcare system. It's always about management and having visits just to manage medications. Isn't that kind of, I don't know, weird, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I tell patients, especially my ones who I only see once a year or twice a year, I tell them, you're my favorite type of patient. You're just healthy and living your life. And, you know, they'll call me if they get sick or we'll do labs once a year, but those are my favorite patients because they really are, they're doing the work and they're just healthy. And it's kind of sad that that's the anomaly. Even for me at this point, it's sort of an anomaly.
It is. And, you know, let's talk a bit about these diseases, these chronic diseases that are showing up so much earlier. I mean, hypertension in a teen or a preteen is, I don't think I've ever heard of that before. Have you?
I don't think so. I mean, I think you could think of like a rare case where somebody has a strange thing, but not for the average teen or preteen. They shouldn't have hypertension.
And do you think that food, I think food is medicine, but is there something about our health, our food system, in your opinion, that's driving this?
I think that, definitely. I think that there's a few things. I think that I think we're eating too many processed and ultra processed foods. We've sort of lost the home cooking, sitting down to dinner and eating a nutritious meal. And so kids are relying on prepackaged foods that are nutrient poor. So we're overfed and undernourished. And maybe that child with or teen with hypertension, maybe they're overweight or obese, or maybe they're not getting enough magnesium in their diet because the foods they're eating are so poor in minerals.
So at this point, for everybody, because everybody I think would benefit, what are some of the supplements you just described, magnesium, what are supplements that you would recommend that everybody as a health foundation need to start getting into their diet?
So some of the supplements that I recommend a lot, you know, if people aren't eating cultured food, I'll have them take a probiotic. We don't get enough essential fatty acids in our diet, or we eat so many foods that are rich in omega-6 fatty acids that we don't have a balance of omega-3s. So some kind of fish oil, I like a lot of patients to be on. And then for my generally healthy patients, I'll have them take a well-rounded multivitamin. So those three are sort of my go-tos. If somebody, you know, is the picture of health and we're just doing a few supportive things, we can definitely get away with that. But I'll encourage them to eat those cultured foods and not take that probiotic.
Got you. So things like, was it kefir? And I guess, natural yogurt that's not pasteurized. That's another thing. Everything's pasteurized. So how is that actually active culture?
Yeah, I think you have to find foods that have active cultures, definitely. And yogurt is, even yogurt and the cultured dairy products are kind of tricky too, because they'll load them up with a lot of sugar to take that sour. I mean, I love how it tastes, but they'll load them up with sugar. There's also, like, if you get sauerkraut that's refrigerated, not the kind that's in the jar on the shelf, but sauerkraut, there's water kefir. There's a lot of cultured products out there. Kimchi is another really good one as well.
I mean, simple things like that, just incorporating that into your diet. What about things like vitamin D? There's, you know, we slather on sunscreen, but is the sun really a problem, or do you need it?
I think we need the sun. I think that I think it's been overplayed, the fact that we should be afraid of the sun. I've heard that message pretty much my entire life. And I think we need to, I think if we could back off of that, it would be better for our health. I think we can be smart about our sun exposure. I don't think we need to be, you know, laying in the sun and getting blistered or anything, but getting a healthy dose of sunlight definitely benefits our mood. It'll, you know, it benefits our vitamin D levels. It does a lot of good for us.
And to go back to the pre-diabetic issue, I mean, there's medications that keep mushrooming up. But from a diet standpoint, is there, in your opinion, a better, I mean, it may be individualized, but some of the diets you think actually will help bring down your blood sugar, help control your cholesterol level, and that you can actually stick with? What would you recommend? Which diet?
So I really gravitate towards, I like the Mediterranean diet, just if people can keep it on the lower carb side, if they are pre-diabetic. I also gravitate towards a paleo diet, or even a Weston A. Price style diet, where we're taking, where we're bringing back those traditional foods into our diet. So I really do like diet. I say a lot, eat food that looks like it did when it came from the farm. I feel like I say that on repeat. And then, you know, if somebody needs a firmer structure, I'll say, you know, go towards a Mediterranean or a paleo diet. And that depends on what they think, you know, we'll talk about what resonates with the patient and what they can actually stick to. Yeah, because I don't want somebody going off the rails and, you know, and eating a bunch of Twinkies or Doritos because they just feel deprived on a very strict diet.
Well, correct me, I don't really know. Paleo, that's not the same as keto, right?
That's right. Paleo is not as restrictive when it comes to your carbohydrate intake like keto is. So with a paleo diet, you're basically eating meats, vegetables, fruits. It is a grain-free diet. And on my version of keto, paleo, I'll include dairy, even though on a strict paleo diet, it does not really include dairy. But if somebody tolerates dairy, I just tell them that that's fine to include.
Gotcha. Yeah. And you mentioned magnesium. I just wanted to revisit that.
Yeah.
I know some of the medications can leach it out, like the omeprazole class of antacids. Why is magnesium important?
Magnesium is necessary for, I wish I had an actual number. We probably don't even know how many biochemical reactions in our body magnesium is important for. But more specifically with something like hypertension, you know, we know that you need the calcium to get the muscles in our arteries to contract, and that magnesium to help it relax. So with low magnesium, it can contribute to hypertension just because our muscular arterial walls can't relax like they should. And a lot of people are deficient in magnesium.
And is there a better formulation, glycinate versus, arginate, glycinate? Is there a difference between absorption?
Magnesium oxide is what you find in milk of magnesia, and it I mean, it's a form of magnesium, but it's probably going to irritate your gut and cause some cramping and probably some diarrhea. So you can, you know, magnesium citrate is more absorbable for a lot of people, but magnesium glycinate is generally what I find to be most gentle on the gut.
Got you. And iodine, that's another big one. Now that I remember when I was a kid, it used to be iodized salt, and now it's not. I think it's brominated, which messes with the thyroid. It thinks it's a halogen and it takes it up, but it can mess with thyroid function. Is there any other, you know, body uses for iodine? Is it just the thyroid, or is that important in general?
I think, you know, iodine is important, and I do generally think of it as, you know, it's critical that we get enough iodine for proper thyroid function. And I don't know how many patients you see who are hypothyroid, but I see a lot. Yeah. And so a lot of times I will put people, if I like it when they can eat their, you know, their nutrients. So we talk about seaweed and how that's a very rich source of iodine, but culturally we don't eat a lot of seaweed. I was preparing a lesson for one of my coaching programs that I do. And I was reading that in Japan, where they do eat a lot of seaweed, their incidence of hypothyroid is much lower than ours. So a lot of times I'll have patients take a little iodine if they need that support.
Got you. Now we're going to take a break, a last break. And I wanted to get your overall view of how we can, as physicians, be the standard that helps patients see that they have choices, and choices they make either will help them or not. So let's take our last break and come back. You're living in the solution.
You're listening to Dr. Elaine George, advocate for living in the solution.
Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Amber Belt. And Dr. Belt, how can people go to your website and find out more about what you do?
Yeah, my website is dramberbelt.com, and I am pretty sure you have to type the www in front of it. You have to go old school. And on my website, I have a lot of, you know, free resources on there, and I have some handouts you can take advantage of. And there's I have a lot of information on my website, and I, you know, I'm always in the process of adding more.
I love it. And I know that you founded a company with your husband called Sage Sirona. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So Sage Sirona is our, you know, like you said, I founded it with my husband, and we focus more on natural first aid and natural acute care in that mm-hmm. business. And it has its own website, which is sagesirona.com. And that's, it's fun because it's just a little bit different focused, and which for me, I don't know why acute care and first aid is fun, but it is talking about it in a naturopathic way.
Well, I think everybody needs to have more than one skill set. We don't know when, if you got a forage or something, you need to know what you need to be getting to help yourself, I would think. Uh-huh. So, I mean, empowerment is being prepared. And yes, that to me means in all facets, your mind, your body, your spirit. And if you have some technical skills, it just gives you a whole nother level that you don't have to, you know, you run out, you can't get to the pharmacy, or you're stuck doing out with nobody around you. You just can make it through. And, you know, fear to me is the worst. That's the thing to me that damages all relationships, because it doesn't allow you to be vulnerable. It doesn't allow you to admit when you're wrong. Someone else is to blame. It's always something negative that seems to come out of fear. And communication with, mm-hmm. to me, it's, I'm sure you have the same experience, that people feel like they can tell you things because you're there as a, to listen and not to judge. Yeah. But those patients, I find when you make that connection and you've just given them the ability to trust their own judgment, to say, it's okay, I have to take care of myself first, because people, depends on the patient, obviously, but some people are so giving that they get sick and they just keep going, but they don't examine the cost of it, whether that's anger or frustration, whatever. That's what makes, to me, the practice of medicine really fun, because you can they're vulnerable with you if you listen. And then open the gate to, how can we fix this? Now that I know there's a problem and I've identified it, now I can help get the patient to make changes that are going to help them. Yeah. Is that your experience?
Yeah, definitely. If a patient can be vulnerable, and I think that really helps them recognize that there is something wrong. I think a lot of times, you're right, people just kind of get sick and keep going. And if you can help them dig in to not only the physical cause, but the emotional causes, one thing that I see all the time is, whatever ailment they had started with grief. And so a lot of times we have to go back to that or another big stressor in their life. But a lot of times that is the thing that tips them over into illness. And we have to address that grief in some way, shape, or form for them to really get unstuck.
It's mind and body, right? I just said it today to one of my patients. I think they're connected.
Yeah.
If you're not able to express it, I find the people who are the most stoic end up with things like GI issues, and they get sick often. The immune system takes a little bit of a dip. I mean, you've heard this, but I think it's more true than not. What's your experience?
Yeah, if you don't listen, your body's going to tell you one way or another. And I think it was my husband who said this, if you don't listen to the whisper, I think he was talking about kind of the universe in general. He said, if the universe is whispering at you and you don't listen, it's going to scream. And I think the exact same thing is true in our bodies. And it is the mind-body connection there that we need to recognize more.
Do you have other modalities like biofeedback or, I don't know, red light therapy, other things that you think that can be added to the patient experience?
Yeah, I use a lot of, I don't do a lot of biofeedback, but I have patients use red light therapy a lot, sauna a lot. We will, if there's really a strong emotional root, I'll have them. I have a person I refer to, he's really good at the EMF tapping, where you're tapping on acupuncture points to help kind of move through emotional issues. And I always think of it, and I might be saying it wrong, I always think of it as sort of a retraining of the nervous system. Mm-hmm. Homeopathy is really wonderful at getting people to shift emotionally and physically. And so is acupuncture. So there are a lot of modalities we can use to help with the mind body ailments.
Do you ever use anything like essential oils?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I use them more personally than with patients, but I do love essential oils.
Got you. I mean, it's light therapy. There's sound and there's like, what's it? The sound baths.
Yes.
It's like, there's so many, we have all these senses. I think we just experience just so few, and it's just taking a step back and knowing that you're just part of a larger whole. Sometimes that's all you kind of need. It's like, it's not about me all the time. And I need to live in the present and I can't change what already happened. And I can't change what's going to happen. Only what I'm thinking now. I don't know. It took me a while to get to that point, because if you don't, anything that comes to it doesn't fit your worldview, it upsets you. Yes. And then you end up in this constant state of being just not present and not happy.
Yeah. And you know what I'm finding with patients is that I think we've been just, in general, the world at large has been pushing fear for so long. I think people are getting tired of being afraid and discontent. And so I do see a shift happening where people want knowledge and they want that empowerment. So I think, I'm hoping really good things are coming.
I can't get in. Well, I can't say that, but we can move away from, it's like a painful stimulus. You move away from it. You don't keep going towards it. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think, going back to what you said about using all those other modalities and feeling like you're part of something bigger, that's empowering too. I find that really empowering that, you don't have to take a medication to like to feel healthy or feel better, you can do other things. And I, patients find that really empowering. And so do I.
Agreed. You know, I just thought just popped my mind, just popped out for a second. But in terms of giving your patients that space, do you find that they share this with their mom, their dad, their loved ones? Do you think there's a movement towards it's working for me, so therefore it's like throwing a rock in a pond, it ripples to other people?
Mm-hmm. I think so. And I think it always depends on the person, right? Maybe their spouse is so shut down about it that they can't really share. But mm-hmm. I do find that people, when they start to feel better and they have more energy, they do share. And I have I'll have one patient come to me, and then over time I'm seeing the whole family, which is great, because what a useful dynamic for me to know about, right? In terms of helping everyone heal in their family.
I agreed. I mean, it's just so empowering, I think, to have a physician and a relationship that you're not being chastised or belittled or somehow ignored, mm-hmm. and that you can feel free. And I think if one person's empowered, it does expand. And people may not notice it, but energetically, I think they feel it. And in a good way, I'm saying.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I think, if they're not so, fatigued and not sleeping, they start to share their joy. It's wonderful to see.
Yeah, that's infectious. You know, you just move away from people who are not positive. And again, either they're going to join by changing their dynamic and their energy, or, you're living in a whole nother existence. Now, you also see patients by telemedicine. So do you see patients out of state from where you live?
So I am licensed to practice in Kansas and Arizona. So if I see a telemedicine patient, they need to be in Kansas or Arizona at the time of our visit.
Gotcha.
So it's a lot more tricky when they're out of state.
Understood. And are you going to be doing anything, conferences or any seminars that people need to know about?
I don't have any conferences that I would be speaking at. I'm certainly taking some for my continuing education, but I am starting to set up some more group coaching programs to try to make, the naturopathic approach more accessible to people. And in a group setting where I can coach them, we're not technically entering into that doctor-patient relationship. So I just started my first round of one specifically geared towards hypertension about 5 weeks ago, and it's going really well. One of the people in the group shared that she had actually stopped the supplement that I had been talking about, and then added in a little hormone balancing for herself, and her blood pressure had returned to normal. So I thought that was great. So early in the program, I was happy.
Oh, that's awesome. Making a difference, huh?
Yeah.
In the time that we left, I want to make sure people know again how to go to your website and experience what you have to offer.
Yes. So you can find my website at www, you got to put that in there, dramberbelt.com. And then I'm also active on Instagram, where you can get sort of, more short content and a taste of my personality. From there, I do encourage people, if they want, more kind of long form information from me, to get on my email list, because social media is, it's sort of the goldfish thing. You only got about 5 seconds to grab people. But if you want the more in-depth info, my email list is a great thing to access too. And you can get that on the website.
And for your other business, for the Sage Sirona, mm-hmm. how can people contact or go to that website and get stuff from it?
Yeah. So sagesirona.com. So Sage, and then Sirona is Sirona. And we're kind of doing a little bit of a revamp right now, but I'll be back with some products that I think will be better for folks. And then I also have an Instagram for Sage Sirona as well. And so those are the two ways to get in touch with that end of my company.
Excellent. You know, Dr. Bell, time goes way too quickly, but I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me back.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for coming back. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.